Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corin. So in our recent episode, we talked about air quality and specifically indoor air quality, HEPA filters and the variables one can measure in the indoor context. And there's also, of course, outdoor air quality. I know just a little bit about outdoor air quality from keeping one eye on it during the forest fires we've had here in Israel. Living in Jerusalem, in the summer, you get these forest fires, and some of them are definitely started by arson. I'm not sure all of them are, but those aren't too far away. The Jerusalem Hills is just off to the west of the city, and often the territory around there, out towards Beit Shemesh, where it started previously, a number of times living here over the years, you smell in the air conditioner coming in before you even read about it in the news, this distinctive smell from, I guess, burning wood. I took some photos during one of the worst forest fires that kind of looked like something out of the apocalypse. The sky was completely turned that kind of orangey tint because it was blowing over towards Jerusalem. Those are the only times I really check the air quality because, as I mentioned in all these air quality episodes, I have asthma. And you want to know, you want to make sure that when there's a big event like this happening, the air is, you know, is safe for you to be outdoors in. I was surprised to see that air quality in Israel is generally pretty poor. I believe that the average air quality of our major cities like Jerusalem even just on a regular day, they're pretty bad actually. It's more polluted than Western cities, including inner city London. There is a lot of great projects out there for monitoring and open sourcing air quality data. The one that I found was World Air Quality Index, or WAQI, a bit of a funny acronym, WAQI, and they have literally a global network, as well as the Israeli Ministry of the Environment. So WAQI is like a global feed, and you can really see it's worth, for those interested in the topic, it's worth looking at that data to really see how different air pollution levels are in different countries. In India and China, you've got some places that are crazy bad, but Israel is actually considerably worse, I would say, than most places in Europe and the US, which really surprised me. The parameters, much like I was talking about the parameters I could see in my indoor air quality monitor, we have the big two, PM 2.5 and PM 10, and there's also AQI, the air quality index, which is a computed measure, and there's a couple of ones like ozone that you don't usually see in indoor air quality monitoring. So Herman and Corin, I'd love to get your thoughts on the topic of outdoor air quality monitoring, especially for those with respiratory conditions like asthma and others. I've heard that PM 2.5 is the one we want to probably be paying most attention to, but how would you recommend that those of us with respiratory conditions read and interpret this data to get just to know basically when it's a good idea, maybe even to wear a mask? One of the things I was hoping would stick after COVID and become normalized was wearing a mask if the air quality is really bad. And I've seen some people actually, when those forest fires occur that I mentioned, you actually do see people here donning face masks. Herman and Corin, let's talk about air quality and measuring it. What do those parameters mean? Which ones are particularly pertinent for those with respiratory conditions? And how is global air quality? It seems that the readings here in Israel are quite disappointing. But what about other places of the world? Over to you two.
You ever look out the window and feel like you have been transported to the set of a post-apocalyptic movie? That eerie, orange-tinted sky where the sun looks like a dim, sickly coin. I remember that specific day Daniel was talking about, back in late 2024, when the forest fires were burning in the hills toward Beit Shemesh. The air did not just look wrong, it felt heavy. You could taste the wood smoke in the back of your throat before you even stepped outside. It is a terrifying visual, but for a lot of people, it is becoming a seasonal reality rather than a once-in-a-decade anomaly.
Herman Poppleberry here, and yeah, that orange sky is a visceral reminder that the air we breathe is not a given. It is a complex, shifting cocktail of gases and particles. Daniel sent us this prompt because, as an asthma sufferer living here in Jerusalem, he is literally feeling the impact of these environmental shifts. We have talked about indoor air quality back in episode 320, but outdoor air is a whole different beast. You cannot just slap a HEPA filter on the city of Jerusalem, although with the way technology is moving, some urban planners are certainly trying.
Right, and it is interesting because Daniel mentioned that he noticed air quality here often seems worse than in major Western cities like London or New York. That feels counterintuitive to a lot of people who think of Jerusalem as this breezy mountain city. But when you look at the data from the World Air Quality Index, or WAQI as Daniel called it, the numbers tell a different story. Today, I want us to really pull apart those numbers. What is actually in that hazy air? And more importantly for people like Daniel, how do we translate those abstract numbers into a decision like, should I put on a mask today?
That is the crucial bridge to cross. We have all this data at our fingertips now, but data without interpretation is just noise. To understand why Jerusalem or other cities have poor air, we have to look at the big four parameters Daniel mentioned, PM2.5, PM10, the overall air quality index, and ozone. If we can understand the mechanics of those, we can understand the risk. It is not just about a single number, it is about the story that number is telling about your immediate environment.
Let us start with the one everyone points to as the most dangerous, PM2.5. We hear that term all the time in news reports, but I think most people just think of it as general dust. Can you break down what that actually is and why that specific size matters so much? Because I have heard it is not just about the lungs anymore, it is about the whole body.
It is all about the scale and the chemistry. PM stands for particulate matter. The 2.5 refers to the diameter of the particles in micrometers. To give you a mental image, a single human hair is about 70 micrometers wide. So, we are talking about particles that are about 30 times smaller than the width of a hair. You cannot see them individually. They are microscopic. Because they are so small, they do not get caught in your nose or your upper respiratory tract. When you breathe in PM2.5, those particles travel deep into the alveoli, the tiny air sacs in your lungs.
And that is where the real trouble starts, right? They do not just sit there.
Exactly. Because they are so small, they can actually cross the alveolar capillary membrane and enter your bloodstream directly. Once they're in the blood, they're essentially on a highway to every organ in your body. We are talking about the heart, the liver, and even the brain. Recent studies from 2024 and 2025 have shown that ultrafine particles can even bypass the blood-brain barrier by traveling up the olfactory nerve. This is why we see links between high PM2.5 exposure and everything from heart attacks to cognitive decline and even Alzheimer's. For someone like Daniel with asthma, the immediate effect is bronchial inflammation, but the long-term systemic risk is what really keeps epidemiologists up at night.
That is the part that always blows my mind. It is not just a lung issue, it becomes a systemic issue. If it is in your blood, it is everywhere. And it is not just the size, right? It is what these things are made of.
Precisely. PM2.5 is a category of size, not a specific substance. It can be made of soot, heavy metals, sulfates, nitrates, or secondary organic aerosols. In a forest fire, like the ones Daniel mentioned, it is a toxic soup of partially combusted organic material. In a city, it is often tire wear, brake dust, and diesel exhaust. Each of those has a different chemical toxicity. But the small size is the common denominator that allows them to invade your system.
So what about PM10? We often see that number spiking during those massive dust storms we get in the spring and autumn. Is that less dangerous because it is bigger?
PM10 refers to particles up to 10 micrometers. These are things like desert dust, pollen, or mold spores. They are still small, but they tend to get lodged in the upper respiratory tract. They will make you cough, sneeze, and give you that scratchy throat feeling. For an asthmatic, they are still a major trigger because they irritate the airways and can cause a flare-up. However, they generally do not make that deep leap into the blood like the 2.5 particles do. In Israel, we see massive PM10 spikes during the Khamisen or Shirav winds, where dust from the Sahara or the Arabian Peninsula blankets the region. It looks dramatic, and it is definitely bad for you, but from a long-term chronic disease perspective, the invisible PM2.5 is often the bigger villain.
So when Daniel is looking at the hills burning, that smoke is a massive source of PM2.5, right? It is not just ash, it is the combustion byproducts.
Precisely. Forest fires are a PM2.5 factory. You are burning organic material, and the high heat combustion creates these tiny toxic particles. But in a city like Jerusalem, we also have other factors. We have the geography. Jerusalem is a city of hills and valleys, sitting at about 800 meters above sea level. On certain days, we get what is called a temperature inversion. Usually, air gets cooler as you go higher. But sometimes, a layer of warm air sits on top of a layer of cooler air near the ground, acting like a lid on a pot. All the car exhaust from the tunnels, the narrow streets, and the heavy construction just sits there, trapped in the valleys.
That explains the comparison to London. I remember we touched on this in episode 115 when we talked about tobacco policy and the enforcement gap. But the urban design of a city really dictates its breathability. London is relatively flat and has the benefit of those constant Atlantic winds sweeping through. Jerusalem is inland, high up, and surrounded by desert and forests. It is a perfect trap for particulates. Plus, the population density in Israel is among the highest in the OECD, which means more cars per square kilometer.
It really is a perfect storm. And then you have the third factor, ozone. This is one that confuses people because they remember the hole in the ozone layer from the 90s and think ozone is a good thing. And it is, when it is 10 miles up in the stratosphere, protecting us from ultraviolet radiation. But ground-level ozone, or tropospheric ozone, is a different story. It is not emitted directly into the air. It is created by a chemical reaction between oxides of nitrogen, which come from car exhaust, and volatile organic compounds, which come from everything from paint to gasoline, all in the presence of intense sunlight.
Wait, so sunlight is the catalyst? That means on the most beautiful sunny days in Jerusalem, our air quality might actually be worse because of the ozone? That feels like a cruel joke.
It is the great irony of Mediterranean climates. On a bright, hot summer day, the exhaust from the cars on Agrippa Street or Hebron Road reacts with the intense sun, and you get high levels of ground-level ozone. It is a powerful oxidant. It literally scars the lining of your lungs. Think of it like a chemical sunburn on the inside of your respiratory system. For an asthmatic, ozone is a massive trigger because it increases the sensitivity of the lungs to other allergens like pollen. So Daniel might be checking his app and see that the particulate matter is low because there is no wind or dust, but if the ozone is high, he is still going to feel like he cannot catch his breath.
This brings us to the Air Quality Index, or AQI. This is the number most people look at on their phones. It is usually color-coded, green for good, yellow for moderate, orange for unhealthy for sensitive groups, and so on. But how is that number actually calculated? Is it just an average of all those things you mentioned?
Not quite, and this is a common misconception. The AQI is usually determined by the highest value among the individual pollutants being tracked. It is a piecewise linear function. Essentially, the monitoring agency looks at PM2.5, PM10, ozone, carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, and sulfur dioxide. Whichever one is the worst that day becomes the headline AQI number. So if ozone is at a level of 150, which is unhealthy, and everything else is at 50, the AQI for the day is reported as 150. It is a way of highlighting the primary threat. It is the weakest link in the chain principle.
That is a really important distinction. It means you cannot just look at the number. You have to look at what is driving the number. If the AQI is 100 because of PM10 dust, that might mean one thing for a person with hay fever. But if it is 100 because of PM2.5 from a forest fire, that is a much more serious situation for someone with asthma. Daniel needs to know which specific pollutant is peaking to manage his symptoms.
Exactly. And this leads to Daniel's question about how to interpret this data for daily life. When is it time to wear a mask? This is where the post-pandemic world has actually given us a bit of a head start. We all have masks in our drawers now, but not all masks are created equal for air quality. If you are using a standard surgical mask, you are essentially bringing a knife to a gunfight when it comes to PM2.5.
Right. A standard blue surgical mask is designed to catch droplets coming out of your mouth. It is not designed to filter out microscopic particles coming in. They are loose-fitting by design.
Precisely. If you are wearing a surgical mask to protect yourself from forest fire smoke, you are mostly just getting a false sense of security. The gaps around the sides are massive relative to the size of those particles. To filter out PM2.5, you really need an N95 or an FFP2 rated respirator. These are designed to create a tight seal around your face and use electrostatically charged fibers to trap those tiny particles. In 2025, we have even seen the rise of more breathable, high-filtration masks specifically designed for exercise, which might be worth it for Daniel if he is active outdoors.
So, if Daniel sees the AQI hit the orange zone, which is usually anything above 100, and the driver is PM2.5, that is the signal. If you have to be outside, the N95 comes out. But what about the lower numbers? Is there a safe level?
That is the uncomfortable truth. According to the World Health Organization's updated guidelines from 2021, there is no real safe level of PM2.5. They lowered the recommended annual average to just 5 micrograms per cubic meter. For context, Jerusalem often averages between 15 and 25. So even on a good day, we are often above the WHO's ideal health limit. But for practical daily management, I would say for someone with severe asthma, once you hit the high double digits, like 80 or 90, you should be cautious. If the sky is actually turning orange, the AQI is likely well north of 150 or even 200. At that point, you really should stay indoors with the windows closed and an air purifier running. If you must go out, the mask is mandatory.
I want to circle back to why the air quality is so poor in Israel specifically. Daniel mentioned it is worse than many Western cities. We talked about the dust and the forest fires, but there is also the density and the infrastructure, right? I read that Israel has one of the highest rates of vehicle density in the world.
It is a massive factor. Israel is one of the most densely populated countries in the OECD, and the car ownership rate has skyrocketed in the last decade. But it is not just the number of cars, it is the type of traffic. We have a lot of heavy diesel trucks and older buses that are still on the road, although the transition to electric buses in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv is finally picking up steam in 2026. Diesel is a huge source of both PM2.5 and nitrogen oxides. In London, they have implemented the Ultra-Low Emission Zone, or ULEZ, where older, more polluting vehicles have to pay a heavy fee to enter the city. That has drastically improved their air quality. Jerusalem has a low-emission zone in the city center, but the enforcement and the geographic scope are much smaller than what you see in Europe.
It feels like an enforcement gap issue, much like what we talked about in episode 115. We have regulations on the books, like the Clean Air Law, but the actual implementation in a crowded, growing city like Jerusalem is tough. And then there is the construction. It feels like every street in the city is being dug up for the light rail or a new high-rise. That creates a massive amount of local PM10 dust.
Oh, the construction dust is a nightmare for local air quality. If you live next to one of those sites, your personal AQI is going to be much higher than what the official station 3 miles away is reporting. That is one of the limitations of the WAQI data Daniel is looking at. Those stations are often located in specific spots, like on top of a government building or in a park. They give you a general idea of the city's air, but they do not account for hyperlocal pollution. This is why we are seeing a surge in citizen science and low-cost sensors like Purple Air.
That is a great point. If I am walking behind a bus that is belching black smoke, my immediate exposure is off the charts, regardless of what the app says. So, how do we use these tools more effectively? Should we be looking at the trends rather than just the snapshot? Because the snapshot can be misleading.
Trends are everything. Most air quality apps like IQAir or the WAQA website show you a 24-hour graph. You can see when the peaks are. Usually, you see a massive spike during morning and evening rush hour. If you are an asthmatic and you want to go for a run or a walk, you check that graph. Maybe you wait until 11 in the morning when the morning peak has subsided and the wind has picked up a bit. You also want to look at the wind direction. If there is a forest fire to the west and the wind is blowing from the west, you know you are in the line of fire. In Jerusalem, the afternoon sea breeze often clears out the particulates, but can actually bring in ozone from the coastal plain. It is a complex dance.
I am curious about the global perspective Daniel asked about. He mentioned India and China, which are often the poster children for bad air. How does our situation here compare to somewhere like New Delhi or Beijing? Are we even in the same ballpark?
It is a different league, honestly. In New Delhi, during the crop burning season, the AQI can regularly hit 500 or even 900. At that point, the scale literally stops. It is like living in a chimney. Beijing used to be that bad, but they have actually made incredible strides over the last decade. Between 2013 and 2024, they saw a 40% reduction in particulates by moving coal-fired power plants and restricting car use. It shows that aggressive policy works. Israel's air is poor compared to Scandinavia or parts of the United States, but we are not in that extreme hazard zone yet. However, for someone with a respiratory condition, moderate pollution is still a significant health burden. It is all relative to your personal threshold.
It is interesting that you mentioned the United States. They have had their own wake-up call recently with the Canadian wildfires. People in New York City were seeing that same orange sky Daniel described. Suddenly, people who never thought about air quality were downloading these apps and buying N95 masks. It feels like we are entering an era where outdoor air quality is going to be a constant concern for everyone, not just those with asthma. It is becoming a universal health metric like the temperature.
It is the new reality of a warming planet. Drier forests mean more fires. Changing weather patterns mean more dust storms. We are seeing more frequent and more intense dust events coming from the Sahara and the Arabian Peninsula. This is where I think the second order effects get really interesting. If the outdoor air is bad, people stay inside. If they stay inside, they use more air conditioning. Air conditioning uses more power, which, if it is coming from fossil fuels, creates more pollution. It is a feedback loop. We are essentially air conditioning ourselves into a dirtier planet.
And it changes how we design our homes. We talked about this in the asthma management episode, episode 343. If you cannot rely on opening your windows for fresh air because the outside air is toxic, you need a robust mechanical ventilation system with high-grade filtration. We are basically moving toward a world where our homes have to be pressurized bubbles. I have seen some new luxury developments in Tel Aviv advertising integrated air filtration as a key feature.
It sounds sci-fi, but it is already happening in places like Singapore and parts of China. They have buildings with integrated air filtration that keeps the indoor AQI at 10, even when the outside is at 200. In Jerusalem, we still have a lot of older stone buildings that are quite drafty. That means the outdoor air comes right in. If Daniel is sitting in his living room during a forest fire, and he does not have a high-quality air purifier, his indoor air quality is likely almost as bad as the outdoor air. He needs to think about his home as a sanctuary, but that requires active management.
That is a scary thought. It really highlights why individual monitoring is so important. Daniel mentioned he has an indoor monitor, but he is using the global networks for outdoor. Do you think there is value in people having their own outdoor sensors? There are these low-cost ones now, like Purple Air, that use laser counters.
I love the citizen science aspect of Purple Air. They have a map where you can see thousands of individual sensors. Because they are at ground level, often in people's backyards, they give a much more accurate picture of what you are actually breathing on your street compared to the official government station that might be on a rooftop a mile away. If I were Daniel, I would be looking at the Purple Air map for Jerusalem to see the real-time flow of smoke or dust through the neighborhoods. It allows you to see the microclimates of the city. One valley might be clear while the next one over is choked with smoke.
Okay, so let's get practical for a second. Let's say it's a typical Tuesday in Jerusalem. Daniel wakes up, checks his app. The AQI is 75. The primary pollutant is PM2.5. He has to walk to the grocery store. What is the move? Is 75 a mask day?
At 75, most healthy people won't notice much. But for an asthmatic, that is the moderate zone. If he is feeling particularly sensitive that day, or if he has been having a bit of a flare-up, I would say put on a lightweight FFP2 mask. It is not just about the immediate attack, it is about reducing the cumulative load on his lungs. If the number is over 100, then the mask is a no-brainer. and if it's over 150, he should try to minimize his time outside entirely. He should also check the ozone levels if it is a hot day. If ozone is the driver, the mask won't help as much because ozone is a gas, not a particle.
Wait, that is a huge point. Masks do not filter out ozone?
Standard N95 masks do not filter out gases like ozone or nitrogen dioxide. You would need a mask with an activated carbon layer to even begin to address those, and even then, their effectiveness is limited for gases. This is why ozone is so insidious. If the AQI is high because of ozone, your best defense is not a mask. It is staying indoors in a space with an air conditioner, as the cooling coils and filters can sometimes help reduce ozone levels through surface deposition.
What about exercise? That's the one that always gets me. You see people jogging along the main roads in Jerusalem right at 8 in the morning. They are breathing deeply, pulling all that exhaust and particulate matter deep into their lungs. It seems like they are doing more harm than good.
That is probably the worst thing you can do for your respiratory health. When you exercise, you breathe more deeply and more frequently, often through your mouth, which bypasses the natural filtration of your nose. You are essentially vacuuming pollutants into your lungs. If the AQI is anything above 50, I would avoid heavy cardio near busy roads. If it is over 100, move your workout indoors to a filtered environment. It is a hard pill to swallow for people who love being outside, but the long-term damage of exercising in high PM 2.5 environments is well documented. It can lead to reduced lung function and increased cardiovascular risk, even in healthy adults.
You mentioned ozone earlier, and I want to go back to that because it's so invisible. You can't see it like you can see smoke or dust. Is there a specific time of day when ozone is at its worst? Can Daniel plan his day around it?
Yes, it follows the sun. Ozone levels are typically lowest in the early morning. They build up through the day as the sun hits the car exhaust, and they peak in the late afternoon, usually between 3 and 6 in the evening. Then they drop off after sunset. So, if Daniel is worried about ozone, his best bet is to do his outdoor errands as early as possible. This is the opposite of the particulate advice, where the morning rush hour is the worst, so you really have to be a bit of a tactician with your schedule. Morning for low ozone, midday for low particulates, evening for, well, staying inside.
It's like a game of environmental chess. Morning for lower ozone, but higher particulates. Midday for lower particulates, but higher ozone. It's exhausting just thinking about it. But I guess that's the reality for someone with a chronic condition. You have to be aware of the invisible threats.
It is. But the tools we have now are so much better than they were even 5 years ago. The fact that Daniel can pull up a global map and see the air quality in real time is a massive win for public health. It allows for informed consent. You aren't just walking into a cloud of smoke blindly. You know what's there, and you can choose how to protect yourself. We are moving from a world of general warnings to a world of personalized environmental data.
I'm curious about the why. Why is Jerusalem's air often worse than Western cities beyond just the geography? Is there a cultural or industrial component we're missing? I know we have a lot of construction, but is there more to it?
There is a massive regional component. We are downwind of some of the most polluted areas in the Eastern Mediterranean. We get industrial runoff from the coastal plain, which then gets pushed up into the mountains. But also, think about the regional politics. Environmental regulation is a luxury of stable, wealthy states. Many of our neighbors do not have the same stringent controls on industrial emissions or vehicle standards that Europe does. Air does not respect borders. If there is a massive fire or a poorly regulated factory a few dozen miles away in any direction, that pollution is coming here. We are also subject to the Mediterranean's unique chemistry, where the sea air can actually interact with urban pollution to create more secondary particles.
That's a sobering point. We can do everything right within our city limits, but we are still subject to the regional airshed. It really emphasizes the need for international cooperation on air quality, which is obviously a tall order in this part of the world. It is the ultimate shared resource and the ultimate shared risk.
It really is. I think this is where the misconception busting comes in. People think of air pollution as a city problem, like a smog cloud over a factory, but it's actually a fluid, dynamic system that spans continents. That Saharan dust Daniel sees? That travels all the way across the Atlantic to the Amazon rainforest. The smoke from the forest fires in the Jerusalem hills can reach Cyprus or even Greece. We are all connected by these invisible threads of particulate matter.
So, looking forward, what do you see changing? Are we going to see better monitoring, better masks, or are we just going to get used to the orange sky and the constant app checking?
I think we will see a massive push for hyperlocal monitoring. Imagine every street lamp in Jerusalem having a small air quality sensor. Your phone could then give you a route for your walk that minimizes exposure to pollutants. Turn left here because the air is cleaner on this street. That kind of technology is already in pilot programs in London and Chicago. And on the policy side, I think the push for electric vehicles is going to be the single biggest win for urban air quality. If you take the internal combustion engine out of the narrow streets of the old city or the center of town, you solve the ozone and the primary PM2.5 problem almost overnight.
That would be a game changer. Imagine a quiet, clean-smelling Jerusalem. It almost sounds too good to be true. But until then, we have to rely on the data. Daniel's use of the World Air Quality Index is exactly the right approach. It's about taking that abstract data and turning it into a personal health strategy. It is about taking control of your own biology in an increasingly unpredictable environment.
Exactly. And for our listeners who don't have asthma, don't be complacent. The effects of poor air quality are cumulative. Every time you breathe in those PM2.5 particles, you are putting a tiny bit of stress on your cardiovascular system. It is worth paying attention to the numbers, even if you feel fine. Think of it like a weather report. You wouldn't walk out into a rainstorm without an umbrella. Why walk into a pollution spike without a plan?
I love that analogy. An umbrella for your lungs. It really puts it into perspective. And honestly, I think we should all get more comfortable with the idea of wearing a mask for pollution. In many Asian cities, it's been a social norm for decades. It's not about fear, it's about common sense. If the air is bad, you put on a filter. Simple as that. We need to get over the social awkwardness of it.
I agree. I think the stigma is fading. When the sky is orange, nobody looks twice at someone in an N95. They probably just wish they had one too. And for Daniel, it's a tool for freedom. It means he can still go out and live his life in Jerusalem, even when the environment is challenging. It is about resilience.
This has been such a deep dive, Herman. I feel like I've learned a lot about the air I'm breathing right now. It's one of those things you take for granted until it's literally in your face or in your blood, as we learned today.
It's the most basic human need, right? We can go weeks without food, days without water, but only minutes without air. It's worth knowing what's in it, and it is worth fighting for cleaner air for everyone.
Absolutely. And hey, to our listeners, if you've found this discussion helpful, or if you have your own experiences with air quality monitoring in your city, we'd love to hear about it. We've done over 400 episodes now, and it's the feedback from people like you that keeps us digging into these weird and wonderful topics.
Yeah, it really does. And if you haven't yet, please leave us a review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It genuinely helps other people find the show and join our little community of curious minds. We are trying to build a resource here for everyone.
Thanks again to Daniel for sending in this prompt. It's a heavy topic, literally and figuratively, but so important for everyone living in an urban environment today. We hope this gives you some concrete tools for managing your asthma in Jerusalem.
Definitely. Stay safe out there, keep an eye on those AQI numbers, and maybe keep an N95 in your bag, just in case. You never know when the wind might shift.
Good advice. You can find all our past episodes, including the ones on indoor air and asthma management, at myweirdprompts.com. We've got a full archive there, and an RSS feed if you want to make sure you never miss an episode.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you in the next one.
See ya.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.